Thanks for making Current State part of your Tuesday. I'm Mark Bayshore here on 90.5 WKAR. Many of the Michigan programs that educate aspiring teachers are struggling to prepare them for the classroom. According to a comprehensive review of more than 1,000 teacher preparation programs in the nation, that is according to the Detroit Free Press's Lori Higgins. The ratings arrived today from the National Council on Teacher Quality. We also noticed that East Lansing Senator Gretchen Whitmer says that Medicaid expansion is on the agenda today at the Senate. That was a tweet from the senator here just a few minutes ago. Coming up on Current State today, Great Lakes fish populations and how they've changed over the years. Lord Huron performs tonight in Lansing. We'll check in with the band's Ben Schneider and the Greater Lansing Sports Hall of Fame. At the top of the show, there are changes to report that the Ingham County Land Bank, the office, which often refurbishes tax foreclosed property and then resells it, has a new executive director. Jeff Burdick is already navigating various new challenges and opportunities. We'll meet Jeff shortly. And curiously, the land bank is involved in a pilot project involving transportation. The Ingham County Land Bank is part of a plan to launch what it says would be the first public bike sharing program in a Michigan city. Here to explain, chairman of the Ingham County Land Bank and the county treasurer, Eric Schertzing, along with the organization's new executive director, Jeff Burdick. Eric and Jeff, welcome to Current State.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
Thank you, Mark.
Let's open up with this bike sharing project. Eric, what's happening exactly?
Well, you know, we want to make sure that people know that we're more than just houses. We are a community and economic development enterprise. A bike share, think of it as zip cars for bikes. I mean, I think that's really the best way for people to wrap their minds around it. It is a way for somebody, whether they're a visitor to the community or an apartment dweller that doesn't want to schlep a bike up and down, to go out and rent a bike. They can have a membership and then also rent it and do an errand, go to lunch, go on the river walk. We're hoping to have probably 9 or so stations up and down Michigan Avenue from Lansing City Hall, perhaps as far east as Frandor, also up to Old Town to the north and Rio Town to the south. It's going to kick off August 4th. We've got the bikes ordered, working with a Michigan startup, A2B Bike Share. And we're going to see how the community embraces this. We have been working on it for a couple of years ago. Some folks may remember we did a survey that got about 1,000 responses 2 years ago from folks talking about where in this, you know, metropolitan urban core of Lansing, East Lansing, folks might be interested in making use of bikes. And it's not easy to get 1,000 responses, so we were heartened by that much enthusiasm for it when we started.
This is an interesting reminder that the land bank is involved in things other than property and real estate and that kind of thing. It is part of your charge. Community development is part of your charge, and the bike sharing falls under that under that mission.
Absolutely. And then, of course, you know, the Snyder administration has been very keen on placemaking as part of economic development. And this is one of those tools, this last mile of mobility that might link a bus up to a business or somebody in their apartment to a business. This is part of that last thing that you need to bring to really make the streets and the community, the neighborhood dynamic.
The Ingham County Land Bank is arguably best known for refurbishing tax foreclosed property and then reselling those properties. Judging from what you told the Lansing State Journal last week, you've got less budget to work with than you have in the past. Jeff Burdick, why less funding?
A lot of the funding that we've received and a lot of communities throughout the state has received have been through the NSP.
Neighborhood Stabilization
Program.
Right.
That program is winding down. If you look at, you know, if you listen to what it's called, Neighborhood Stabilization Program, it was federal funding that was supposed to stabilize neighborhoods. And the way some of the challenges we're going to have now is seeing how that funding really affected the private market.
Okay.
And it's the private, are private developers willing to do some of these rehabs themselves based on the amount of funding that was put in from the federal government for public sector to do these rehabs. So what I'd like to see is the land bank re-engage with private developers to do housing and to do redevelopment and kind of show that the NSP has been productive and has stabilized neighborhoods to the point where private developers do want to invest in neighborhoods.
Take up the mission. And,
exactly.
Okay, and remind our listeners how the NSP money was spent, Eric.
Well, we've had three different go-arounds of neighborhood stabilization program dollars. This is a partnership with the City of Lansing, between the county, the land bank, and the City of Lansing. And, you know, it primarily has done a couple of things. It allowed us to pick up blighted tax and mortgage foreclosed properties. A number of those were demolished. And, for example, last year we demolished 100 houses in the City of Lansing. And also a lot of renovation work. We've done, you know, over 100 houses have been renovated or built new that we've then marketed and sold, and sales have gone well.
You're working less on single-family homes, I read, and more with developers. Tell us a little bit more about that, Jeff.
Well, we are still working predominantly
on
single-family,
but
our
homes,
goal
but,
is
yeah.
to foray into multifamily. Most cities in Michigan, unlike other states in the country, don't have a lot of housing options besides single family and duplex housing. And we see a market for multifamily flats, mixed use. If you look at Lansing's master plan, which was adopted last year, it looks at the corridors and how the corridors in the City of Lansing need much, not only visual improvement, but new development to enhance the aesthetics of those corridors. So when we get property that are along major corridors, we want to hold those properties and look at either mixed-use development or development that's not traditional to what we've been doing in the past, which is mostly single-family.
Okay, so a larger, more larger-scale involvement?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, don't think of them though really as that much of larger scale. It can be, you know, triplexes or townhouses, row houses. It's a different middle housing product between single family and apartment buildings, and that's missing.
Geographically, are there areas that you expect to be working on more in the future than in the past?
The neighborhood stabilization dollars, we tried to use them as strategically as possible in cooperation with Mayor Bonero and the city to look at the corridors. The neighborhoods look pretty good once you get into them. We've done a lot of single-family rehab to improve the neighborhoods. But the challenge in a lot of our communities is the quality of the corridors. A lot of, you know, old buildings, houses that had additions put on to turn them into businesses.
Can you give me some examples?
Michigan Avenue is beginning to transform. I would talk about Pennsylvania from 496 to the zoo, or even more importantly, 496 up to the highway, up to Michigan Avenue. These are some of the front doors to our community that people from around, you know, the region, if not around the world, when they come into Lansing, they see. You know, and we want to make those areas more vibrant and housing, more dense housing, you know, row houses, townhouses, raised ranch, flats and stuff. There's just a lot of different housing options that will fit those corridors.
We're talking with Eric Schertzing and Jeff Burdick of the Ingham County Land Bank. Jeff, where are you coming from, and what qualifies you as executive director of the Ingham County Land Bank?
Well, Mark, I spent 6 years at the Genesee County Land Bank, which was the first land bank to be formalized in the state of Michigan. I was there from 2003 to 2009 as the community development planner. Since then, my family's moved on. We were in North Carolina for a time being. My background is in urban planning, so I was working as a planner for different communities in North Carolina. And
there was a lot to keep you busy in Genesee County.
There was.
I take it.
Yes.
As challenged as we were in Ingham County, they were arguably a good deal more challenged in Genesee. General, what was that experience like?
That experience was, as you got away from the experience and as I was further removed, it was much more rewarding. At the time, it was often, most of what we deal with, it was a very different beast than what we're dealing with in Lansing in terms of the types of neighborhoods we were working in. We were working in neighborhoods that were predominantly vacant already. So a lot of the work I was doing was working with fledgling neighborhood groups to figure out what to best do with these properties that wasn't going to really involve development, because development could not, Flint could not support development.
It was more addressing blight than it was,
exactly,
say, individual vacant family homes.
So a lot of urban gardening programs, community cleanup programs,
more
demolition.
More like Detroit than, say, like Lansing?
Arguably. Most definitely.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, and I know you told the State Journal that the number of properties, you still expect to be going up. I was a little surprised by that, Eric, in that the recession is gradually receding further and further into history. We are undergoing some sort of real estate recovery, but you still expect the number of properties managed by the land bank to be going up. Why is that?
Well, so this is the Treasure Land Bank hat. There's always been this challenge to help people fully understand the differences in the magnitude between mortgage foreclosures and tax foreclosures. Mortgage foreclosures have been improving for a couple years.
Gotcha.
But tax foreclosures tend to lag the rest of the market by a couple years. So the treasurer, unfortunately, continues to see this year and into next year very high levels of tax foreclosure. And that's the foreclosures that are feeding the land bank inventory.
Clarify for me, though, in an ideal world, one in which taxes and mortgages are always paid, does the Ingham County Land Bank have a mission? I mean, isn't the ideal for a public land bank to have as little work to do as possible?
It would be nice to work ourselves out of business, and I think that's what we're trying to do. But there's a reality in the marketplace for urban core, actually for any place in Michigan. Capitalism does not clean up blight. The last thing an investor in a house does is not take $10,000 and demolish the structure. So for 100 years, blight has been turned over to the public sector for you and I through our tax dollars and programs to deal with. And there will always be a level of blight in our communities that the land bank will probably need to address. It'll be much lower than it is today. It might be 25% of what we're dealing with right now, but there'll always be a substantial amount of blight because, as I say, the last thing a home investor that's renting it out, they don't take the house down once they've wore it out.
Mm-hmm.
They just leave it sit.
Jeff Burdick, what are you looking forward to most about working in Ingham County? How long have you been in town?
I've been here for a month.
A month.
What's
your impressions and what are you?
He's got it all figured out.
Yeah. What are you most excited
about? Well, I'll tell
you,
it's much where I've come from. It's much easier to get your arms around the situation. You say we have 920 properties, which sure seems like a lot to the folks out there listening, but that's compared to thousands of properties that we were dealing with in Flint. So it's just much easier for me, especially as a planner and looking at certain how the impact that we can have in certain neighborhoods. It's much easier for me to see how we can have a positive impact than when you're working with thousands of properties scattered throughout an entire city.
It's more manageable. It's just a more manageable landscape.
It seems to be more manageable. I mean, there's going to be a lot of challenges, of course, especially changing our mission to besides just single family. That's going to be a change, and we're inexperienced in that realm, so we're going to have to work with a lot of partners, and it's going to be a lot of partnership building. But just the manageability of the situation, it's large enough that you can have an impact, small enough that you can kind of get your brain wrapped around it.
Interesting. Jeff Burdick is the new executive director of the Ingham County Land Bank. We've been joined also by the chairman and the Ingham County treasurer, Eric Schertzing. Thanks an awful lot for joining us.
Thanks,
thank you, Mark.
Have a great day.
Down the middle. Another pass to Worthy. Here's a pass under to Worthy. Nobody looking at him, and he scores. Magic threw the ball right past the redhead's ear.
Magic coming out of the backcourt. Turns around McDaniel. He's down the middle around Ellis. He bounces the ball under Worthy, and he's got two more. They need timeout, and they call.
Strike three call. Strikes out the side. 5Ks for Smoltz. Backcourt. Little strikeout number 7 for John Smoltz. 2 down here in the fifth.
At wide receiver from Michigan State, number 87, Mohsen Mohamed.
Heaves it downfield for Mohamed in the end zone. He got it! Touchdown! What a great catch by Mohsin Mohammed! The Panthers!
Magic Johnson, John Smoltz, Mohsin Mohammed, and many other mid-Michigan sports legends are enshrined in the Greater Lansing Sports Hall of Fame. The hall is located in the Lansing Center and is a treasure trove of sports jerseys, vintage photos, sports equipment, and other memorabilia. The 2013 inductees will enter this July, and Hall of Fame Executive Director Bob Every will preside over the honors. Bob is also enshrined in the Greater Lansing Sports Hall of Fame. He's a well-known area coach and accomplished former boxer. Bob Every recently toured the hall with WKAR's Al Martin, and they began by looking at a pair of golden boxing shoes.
Well, you know, those boots were something that I saw the Marine team wear when I was fighting at the national tournament in San Diego, California, back in 1967. And I really liked the way they looked under the overhead lights. So I decided that I was going to get myself a pair, and I did. And when I went back out to San Diego, California in 69 to compete in the national AAU tournament, I actually wore them for one fight. And I just, you know, I guess I just figured out that they weren't me, you know what I mean?
Exactly. A little too flashy.
A little too flashy for an old farm boy like me, so.
Right.
But I thought, well, we'll just throw them in here and conversation piece, you know, people can talk about them. But
That's where those came from.
Well,
that's the first thing that caught my eye when I looked at them. I'm like, those boots, I would rock those, man. Those are really stylish, man. They're gold boots. Yeah, explain what they look like.
Well, I don't know. Maybe they're might be a little high-step ballet slippers for all I know. I don't, you know. I mean, people always kind of said that I had a fairly good style of a boxer-puncher combined, and I had good footwork, and I guess I just thought maybe that made me look a little bit more flashier. And let's face it, boxing is a sport where psychologically you try to have every advantage you can.
Gotcha. Thanks. But all right, well, let's continue the tour, man.
The Geringer collection was supplied by one of the workers right here at the Lansing Center. And he was related to Charlie Geringer in some way, some distant way. But he had these things, and he said, you know, I'd like to bring them down and put them on display. So he volunteered those things to us to have on display, and that's why they're here. But as you know, Charlie Geringer was from Fowlerville, that certainly qualifies to be inducted into the Greater Lansing Area Sports Hall of Fame, and he might be the only Hall of Fame member in our Hall of Fame. We have many baseball players, but John Smoltz will be a Hall of Famer eventually, and we'll get around to his plaque in just a little bit. But Geringer certainly is one of the greatest Tigers that ever played the game and wore the uniform, so we figured we had to have that in there and take up a very big spot, you know.
Now, I got to ask you, Bob, but that's one of the things I want to ask you as far as this Hall of Fame, the Lansing Sports Hall of Fame. I mean, what areas qualify you to be in this Hall of Fame?
Yeah, we struggled with that in the beginning, and we came up with the Greater Lansing area being determined by the Lansing State Journal circulation area. So wherever the Lansing State Journal gets out to, and we figured it was about as far, we thought it would be about a 40, 45-mile radius.
That makes sense.
So okay. Let's move on down here. You know, this jacket right there was worn by Dave Porter, who was one of the most iconic wrestlers in collegiate wrestling history. He won two national championships as a heavyweight, had a great amateur career. This is the great Dean Look, the official in the NFL. Magic, we had a retro jersey of Magic up here, and when he got back for the Hall of Fame, he said, no, you got to have an original. So he signed us a jersey and sent it back to us. And then, you know, last year we also brought in Mohsin Mohammed, who's one of the greatest receivers.
Of course, right.
I think Mohsin had sent that to me last year prior to his induction. And when Magic saw that, he said, well, I got to get one up there, too, like Mohsin. But Mohsin is a great guy and he was a great athlete. I think he still holds a record for the longest reception in one play in a Super Bowl game.
Yeah, in a Super Bowl game.
84 yards or something.
And where's Mohsin from?
Well, he's from Lansing here.
From Lansing.
He went to Waverly High School. Mm-hmm. He actually came down to the Crown Boxing Club when he was a young guy in high school, thinking that he might want to box instead of do all the other stuff. But I told him he made the right decision.
Yeah, definitely. Did he get in the ring at all?
Yeah, he did, you know. And of course, he was a pretty good-sized kid back then, but pretty tough kid. But he tried it for a short while, and then he moved on to something else. Now, if you go over in this corner, this is basically what was our team corner. Yeah. Fabian Williams. Fabian Hurricane Williams was the very first national Golden Gloves winner, boxer, out of Lansing, out of the Lansing area.
Wow, he was the first one.
He was the very first national. We've had three national champions, and all three of them have come out of the Crown Boxing Club.
Wow. And Fabian was the very first one.
And that's his belt. Is that the belt
that's
from when he...
That's a belt when he won the North American Boxing Federation Professional Championship.
Wow. Unbelievable,
so,
man.
The robe is... That's professional stuff there. But yeah, we thought that that would be nice. And he's coming in this year. Fabian's coming in this year.
Nice.
Now, this is really interesting. I don't know if you know the history about Victor Sayers. But
no,
Victor
no.
Sayers was... I have some information about Vic Sayers you wouldn't believe. And you remember the great Christy Mathewson?
Yeah.
Christy Mathewson was playing in a game, and I have an article that Christy Mathewson wrote for a publication, and they were talking about this guy hitting this home run off him. He said, the longest home run ever hit off me was hit off a guy by the name of Victor Sayers, and Victor's right here from Lansing. He said he hit that ball so far. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And to have a great pitching legend like Christy Mathewson say that this guy hit the longest home run off him that he ever saw was unbelievable. But that's the retro jersey that he wore back in 1907 when he played for the Cubs and was on an all-star team and was being billed as the greatest first baseman in the era of baseball back then. And he had a couple of injuries. He initially injured himself sliding into home plate, and he was out for several weeks. And then he came back in and he injured himself again. And he never got to the point where Grantland Rice, I believe it was, wrote an article that he was going to be the next superstar of baseball. And so he played in an all-star game, but never reached the peak that I guess
the expectations.
Yeah, exactly.
Now I got to ask you this, Bob. When I look at all this and all these jerseys hanging up here, how did you get in touch with a lot of these athletes to come here and donate all this stuff? This is unbelievable.
Well, persistence, you know. I mean, if you want somebody on your show, you're not going to take no for an answer.
Not taking no for an answer.
And if I want something hung up here, I'm not taking no for an answer. And, you know, it took a lot of road work, a lot of phone calls, a lot of prodding. But, you know, some of the people that we've got things from have since walked through here and saw it and are so happy that they did it because, really, it's just, you know, this really kind of immortalizes you or certainly immortalizes what we're trying to do here. And, you know, I think for anybody to come down, I mean, for Magic to come down and see the jersey that was up there, which was obviously a retro jersey, and then have him say, no, you got to put up an original one and have him send us one.
Right.
Obviously, it means something
without
to these
a
guys.
Doubt.
Yeah.
That's special.
Yep.
That's special, yep. Man.
And then just continuing on over here, we just have. Right. That's the great Sammy Williams who played football at Michigan State. The member of the original Fearsome Foursome that phrase really started in Detroit.
Right.
And
wow.
He, along with Darius McCord, Alex Karras, and Roger Brown, that was the original Fearsome Foursome. Mm-hmm. We picked this jersey. When did we get this, Jeff? About back in December or something? And now Sammy died. He just died recently.
Did he?
Yeah. So we feel real fortunate to have him. Mark Ditsworth, one of the greatest umpires that come out of here, had a good college career himself. Luke Hamlin played for the Brooklyn Dodgers back in 1937. And he finished fourth in the MVP voting that year. And he was one notch above Mel Ott. And
wow.
Mel Ott was, as you know, was a great baseball player, Hall
baseball
of Famer. So, I mean, that's Luke Hamlin's claim to fame is that he beat Mel Ott in Hall of Fame voting. I mean, MVP voting. Brock Gutierrez is coming in this year, and Brock had a long, illustrious career with Cincinnati, the 49ers, and the Detroit Lions. And he's from Charlotte. Quote over here, great Pop Vaness, Al Pop Vaness, who started the Golden Gloves in Lansing. And
now, when you look at this, Bob, because a lot of people, especially where I'm from, Detroit, I mean, when you hear about Lansing, a lot of people don't know that all of these greats have come from here. I mean, you just hear about Magic Johnson, but a lot of people forget that a lot of people in this area, I mean, so how humbling is it when you see all of these names, and you're actually on I'm assuming, on one of these walls, too, because you were inducted in 94.
I'm right up there.
Right up there. Bob Everett, exactly. You know? So, I mean...
Next to John Smoltz.
Right.
And there's a big fight between John Smoltz and Brad Van Pelt to see who could be next to me.
Oh, yeah. Nice. And you're right there next to John Smoltz.
Yeah,
when you look at the culture that Lansing has over the years, and you look at all these great names, I mean, what's that say about Lansing sports?
Well, I've said this many times to many people. I don't know of any area our size that has produced as many well-known athletes as we have. I mean, there might be some just as much, but I'm telling you right now, there's none anymore. When you take a look at the professionals, the Olympians, and then the great high school players that have come out of this area. It is unbelievable. I mean, look at here. You know, Bruce Miller, he played in two Pan American Games. I had a fortune enough to fight in the Olympic trials and then fight on U.S. Amateur Boxing Team. Smaltz, Brad Van Pell, you know, a great football player. He's in the College Football Hall of Fame.
Right.
Julie Ovenhaus over here was in the Olympics. That blazer up there belongs to Kevin Jackson. He was in the Olympics. That's the same blazer he wore when he won his gold medal. You can see the picture
really?
Right there.
Wow.
And then this shirt right here, Carol Hutchins, you know, the great coach at Michigan, who graduated from Michigan State, mm-hmm. played on the AIAW National Championship softball team, the only one that Michigan State ever had. And as a matter of fact, a funny story, we were in here one day. We come in here periodically just to make sure things are going okay and
yeah.
there's no damage
exactly.
and stuff. But I was walking around the corner, and there was this guy, and he was looking at this John Smoltz plaque. And I says, excuse me, you John Smoltz fan? He says, you know, I'm up here on a convention from Atlanta. And he says, I never knew. And I'm a huge Atlanta Braves
right.
baseball fan. I never knew that John Smoltz was from Lansing until I just read it on this plaque.
Until he saw that.
Yep. So,
right. So this serves as an eye-opener to a lot. It's an eye-opener to me right now
yeah.
because, I mean, looking at this, I mean, all these names yeah. that have come from this area is simply mind-boggling.
Yeah, it really wow. is. I mean, and then all these things in here, I mean, they all represent something. I mean, the malls, M-U-L-L, are synonymous with some of the greatest swimmers that ever come out of here. You know, and these are medals won by them in various competitions. And, mm-hmm. and the hockey tradition. We're bringing in the Lansing Laurel softball team this year. You know, they were one of the greatest women's softball, amateur softball programs in the country at the time. And, you know, this poor gal here in the middle, Kay Purvis, she was recognized by the state of Michigan as the first lady of softball years ago. Mm-hmm. And she's in the Hall of Fame. Now, she has, God bless you, she has Alzheimer's, and she's not doing very well. And mm-hmm. I don't know that she's going to be able to make this Hall of Fame ceremony, but certainly mm-hmm. all the other players, like Carol Hutchins, who was on this team, and
yeah.
Kathy Strahan, who coaches out of California,
right.
was on this team, and so many great players. There's three players on that team that are in the softball, the National Fast Pitch Coaches Association Softball Hall of Fame. That is the pinnacle Hall of Fame for anybody
for
that's in softball.
Unbelievable, man. Now, I got to ask you, you look up there, and you see your name and your memorabilia up there in that case.
Yeah.
What goes through your mind? And you look at the names around here. What goes through your mind when you look at that?
Well, first of all, I'm proud. I'm proud to be associated or even be close to John Smoltz.
Yeah, you're right next to John Smoltz up there.
Yeah, they call this every corner, by the way. you know, I had a little bit to do with some of the stuff. There's no doubt about it being the executive director. But you know what? I paid my dues, and I worked hard, and I certainly was able to represent my country and, mm-hmm. and my state and so many boxing venues. That, and I just... I take a look at all this stuff and I say, my goodness, you know, what a great fraternity to be affiliated with.
Right.
I mean, this Hall of Fame is unbelievable in my opinion. And, you know, every town probably our size has something that recognizes athletes. But, you know, this town is really athletic driven and it starts Michigan State. Michigan State starts it, let's
exactly.
face it.
Yeah.
You know,
let's be
but
honest.
So much of what we do in this town is athletic driven that it just made sense for us to develop a Hall of Fame to recognize all these past athletes and then pass the heritage on to other kids who hopefully pass it on to other kids when they get to be older, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's just like if you live in the village of anything's possible, then anything is possible.
Right.
So if you bring kids down here and you let them see this stuff, and you let them read some of the stuff, and you let them see stuff. You know, I mean, where was Kevin Jackson when he won that gold medal? Where do you think that thing has been?
Right.
You know, where do you think John Smoltz's jersey's been?
Right.
I mean, when you look at it in terms like that,
yeah.
you know, then you know that I can do it too. If they
inspiration.
Can do it, I can do it. Yes, inspiration is so much a part of success. It really is.
And
you have to be, you know, you have to have hopes and dreams. I mean, how are you ever going to have a dream come true if you don't have a dream?
Right.
You know, so, I mean, I think people should encourage people to daydream all they want, you know, and to dream about the impossible or dream about this or dream about that. And then align yourself out with people that will help you set that plan of action into place so you can achieve those dreams.
Exactly. Bob Every is the executive director at the Lansing Sports Hall of Fame.
For Kern State, this is Al Martin.
That was Greater Lansing Sports Hall of Fame Executive Director Bob Every with Al Martin. Bob will preside over the 2013 Inductee Honors Ceremony this July. Brown trout, Chinook, and coho salmon are all currently stocked in one or more of the Great Lakes. These fish have helped build the Great Lakes Basin's world-class fishing reputation. However, none of these prized catches are native to the Great Lakes. These fish were introduced to help manage invasive species and to accelerate sport fishing in the region. Over the course of this year, the Department of Natural Resources will stock nearly 19 million fish, including native and non-native species. And here to discuss how Great Lakes fish populations have evolved and how they're maintained is Todd Grischke. Todd is the Lake Huron Basin Coordinator for the Michigan DNR. Todd, welcome.
Thanks for having me this morning.
If I went fishing in the Great Lakes in 1913 then, 100 years ago, what types of fish would I likely have caught, and how is that different from what I might catch today?
Some of it's the same and some of it's very different. 100 years ago, we were looking at primarily lake trout, native species in the Great Lakes that had evolved with the Great Lakes. And actually, 100 years ago, there was not much recreational fishing. Most of it was either subsistence type, near shore, or commercial. So the recreational fishing and boating that we see today is very, very different than what it was 100 years ago. Today, you know, in addition to lake trout now, we've got many other species. You just mentioned some, Chinook, coho, brown trout, but we've got steelhead, we have Atlantic salmon, and, those are all part of the mix of the sport fishing opportunities that are out there now.
I'm curious, when did the Great Lakes region turn the corner and become really the sport fishing destination that it is today? When did that happen?
Well, it started turning in the 50s due to some exotic species getting into the Great Lakes, alewife, sea lamprey. These exotic species started to change the Great Lakes ecosystem. And by the late 1950s, our lake trout populations were nearly gone. They'd been wiped out due to these invasive species and some overfishing that had occurred, you know, in the early part of the 1900s. So in the 60s then, alewife populations had reached just huge numbers. And for those of us that were around, we can remember piles and piles of these things on our beaches because there were so many of them. And fisheries managers at the time looked to other species they could bring in to help control the alewife and also create sport fisheries. And Chinook salmon from the west coast of the United States was one of the key species brought in. And so by the late 1960s, the boom started. And it's now legendary. I mean, Chinook salmon and coho salmon stocked into the Great Lakes created, they built entire towns. Communities grew up around these fisheries, you know, boating industry, restaurants, gas stations, on and on and on, all benefited. And entire economies were created around this frenzy of a new sport fishing opportunity.
So is it fair to look at the last half century, let's say, of sport fishing in the not of sport fishing, but of the DNR's work over the past 50 years with regard to the Great Lakes, and view it as an invasive species and then measures taken to address that invasive species? Is that a fair way to look at the history of the aquatic population of the Great Lakes?
Yeah, and remember, we, the Department of Natural Resources, look at stocking as a tool. It's a tool to rehabilitate a native species such as lake trout. And, you know, lake trout stocking and rehabilitation is still going on. We're still trying to bring back the native species. But it's also a tool to bolster existing populations and create new fishing opportunities. In this situation, it was a management maneuver, an objective being to reduce the invasive species, the alewife, and take advantage of that as an opportunity. So stocking's a tool, and it can be used in different ways. And so while we do create these new fisheries, Chinook and coho and Atlantic salmon, we're also still looking at our native species such as lake trout and walleye, for example, which we stock, to bump those populations up so that at some point they're self-sustaining. And a good example of that is Saginaw Bay over on Lake Huron, where we stocked walleye for many years. And eventually, by the mid-2000s, walleye took off on their own, and we no longer stock.
Yeah.
So,
but I have to ask, if the alewife population is under control, and they were the ones that were so out of control for a while, is that related to the lake trout population? Why is it taking longer to bolster the lake trout population in the Great Lakes?
Well, it's interesting. There is a dynamic between lake trout and alewife that hasn't been understood until in recent times. Alewife contain an enzyme that basically it doesn't allow fish, salmonids, lake trout, for example, to convert thiamine, which is an important nutrient to produce viable eggs.
It's a B vitamin, right?
Yep. And so because alewife were so abundant in the Great Lakes, lake trout were feeding on them, and they were taking in this enzyme, and it was creating a situation where they were just unsuccessful in bringing off naturally reproduced young. What we're seeing now, with the alewife gone, lake trout are starting to convert to other forage fish, other small fishes as prey items. We're starting to see lake trout making a comeback, and we're measuring significant levels of natural reproduction of lake trout now in northern Lake Huron that we haven't seen in decades. So with the alewife under control, lake trout are feeding on other fish. Now they're starting to become successful. And with those alewife gone, we as managers are looking to other species, such as I mentioned steelhead and Atlantic salmon, as fish that we can stock to create other fisheries, and they can feed on forage fish that are not alewife.
We're talking with Todd Grischke, who is the Lake Huron Basin Coordinator for the Michigan DNR. We're talking about the kinds of fish you're apt to find in the Great Lakes and how those populations have varied through the years. Part of your job, obviously, is assessing the numbers between predators and prey. Tell us about that. How do you measure those relationships, and how big a job is that?
It's a big job, and you mentioned a key word, which is relationships. We, as a Department of Natural Resources, work with multiple states, multiple agencies, Native American tribes, Canada, to make these kinds of decisions. And they're partners, really, in the management. And for assessing the forage fish, the prey items that are out there, we rely on one of our partners, the United States Geological Survey, and they have large vessels and the capacity to get out there and measure and provide these numbers and estimates. So with these other partners that I just mentioned, these other states and agencies, we annually and sometimes several times throughout the year get together, evaluate that data, look at what the numbers tell us, and help us make decisions going forward.
Let's talk a little bit more about the Chinook salmon. I take it that the DNR will stock fewer Chinook in Lake Michigan this year. That's an illustration then of how thriving the Chinook population is in that particular lake?
It is. It's a measure of both that, what you just mentioned, and noticing that the alewife population is changing also. When zebra mussels and quagga mussels came into the Great Lakes, they started to take nutrients out of the lake. When that happens, other fish suffer because the nutrients aren't available. So one of the things that we're noticing is that the alewife populations in Lake Michigan are starting to change. There's not a lot of old alewife, which means they're not living a long time. And so we're recognizing the reduction in alewife and also the natural reproduction that's going on with Chinook salmon. As a result, we don't need to stock as many Chinook salmon to provide the same level of fishing that we've enjoyed for the last 20, 30 years.
Understood. Very good. Interesting discussion. Todd Grischke is the Lake Huron Basin Coordinator for the Michigan DNR. We've been talking about fish populations or aquatic populations in the Great Lakes. Thanks, Todd.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
This environmental segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news on the Great Lakes environment is available at greatlakesecho.org. It's Current State on WKAR. Thanks for joining us. Ben Schneider of Okemos has been making waves with his band Lord Huron. Two other guys from Okemos, Mark Berry and Tom Renaud, are in the band as well, along with Miguel Briseño of Eaton Rapids and Californian Carl Kerfoot. Now based in Los Angeles, Lord Huron is touring to support their album Lonesome Dreams with a sold-out show tonight at The Loft here in Lansing. Current State Scott Pohl spoke with Ben Schneider about his music and growing up in a media-savvy household. His parents are well-known Lansing PR executive Sharon Emery and longtime Lansing State Journal columnist John Schneider.
Yeah, it was interesting, you know, especially because, you know, he would focus every Sunday on writing about the family. You know, you'd find people you know at school or elsewhere knowing things about you that maybe you didn't want them to know sometimes. Which you know, it could be good and bad. I mean, it was, looking back on it, it was great. But at the time, you know, being a fairly teenager and having your dad write about, well, in some cases, my band or whatever I was up to, was kind of interesting, you know. But the good side of that was, you know, since they were both interested in media, I was exposed to a lot of great music, a lot of great books, a lot of great writing. So, you know, looking back on it now, it was really a positive household to grow up in.
I want to talk with you a little bit about being a young musician and how young people often struggle with the notion of going into music for a career. When did you know that music would be your life's work?
You know, I think I definitely had a desire to make it my life when I was really young. I remember being in elementary school and the musical acts would kind of visit for assemblies. And I was just impressed with those people. And then with looking through my parents' record collection, you know, just kind of looking at the covers and imagining who these people were that made this music and what their lives were like, and just really aspiring to live a life like that. And, you know, I started my first band when I was 12 and really hoped it would be my life's work. And, you know, like you said, it's a very tough business. So I didn't have much success at it for a long time and kind of, you know, went out into the real world and got a job and kept it as a hobby. And then just a few years ago, kind of started doing it again seriously and really wanted to have another go at it. And this time around, it's been a lot more successful and couldn't be happier about that.
Mom, Dad, I'm moving to L.A. and starting a band.
Yeah, well, it actually came after that. I moved to L.A. kind of, you know, to be honest, kind of following a girl and pursuing a career in painting, which is what I studied in school. And, you know, just found that that world wasn't really a good fit for me and started doing music again.
The Lord Huron album, Lonesome Dreams, got some really positive reviews. I want to ask you about how it's done commercially. How has Lonesome Dreams performed?
Well, you know, records don't sell these days like they used to, you know, especially for a small indie label like we're on. But in that world, it's been above and beyond our expectations. I'm not sure exactly the number of records we've sold. You know, it's nothing like the multi-platinum albums of Days of Yore. But, you know, it's been between record sales and touring, it's been enough to keep keep me going financially. So I couldn't ask for anything more than that. You know, I live pretty simply. As long as I can get by and keep paying my rent and playing music, I'm happy.
One or two of the songs from Lonesome Dreams have been featured on TV shows, and that kind of exposure has to help.
Yeah, absolutely. We definitely see big spikes in sales on iTunes and whatnot after those things happen. And, you know, it's always a kind of a surreal experience to watch a TV show and hear your music playing. Pretty incredible.
Remind us which shows.
The most recent and kind of the biggest one was it appeared on a Showtime show called Shameless. And that was really great because they played the whole song and it kind of ended the episode, so people really remembered it. And that song, which is called Ends of the Earth, has kind of had a big bump in popularity since then. So very thankful for that. We've appeared on a few other shows. You know, I don't remember all of them, to be honest, but I know it's been played on Grey's Anatomy as well, which I think is a really popular show.
Of course, your biggest TV exposure came when The Tonight Show called. Talk about that experience.
Yeah, that was also very surreal.
My next guests are making their first national television appearance with us. They're an L.A.-based folk rock quintet whose debut record, Lonesome Dreams, is garnering a widespread praise. It's garnering.
Okay, got it.
Garnering, wow.
Garnering,
what a
yeah,
use
yeah.
of language.
Here you go. Here to perform Time to Run. Please welcome Lord Huron.
Did it all for you? Well, I hope you know the lengths I've gone to. What's the man say? They'll be looking for me. I should be on my way. I won't let everybody else in the world to know me. I won't let everyone to know you're the girl for me. I won't let everybody else in the world to know me. And I ain't never gonna let them take my life to me.
I remember we had just finished, our van had broken down. We were on tour and we had just finished. We had to rent a couple of small rental cars and jam all of our gear in it and make an epic 16-hour drive to Kentucky. And we were just finishing the drive. We were all exhausted. And that's when we got a call, someone asking us to appear on Tonight Show. And, you know, we all kind of thought it was a fever dream or something, but it was real. And I think that was maybe when my parents finally accepted that maybe I was doing something right.
And you got to meet Sally Field, I assume.
Yeah, yeah, and she was real nice, and Jay's a real nice guy as well.
Lord Huron has played or will play at a number of big music festivals this year, including the big Bonnaroo Festival. Your upcoming schedule includes the Hollywood Bowl and the Newport Folk Festival. I'd like to hear your thoughts on the trajectory of Lord Huron's success. Do you feel like you've made it? And maybe how do you fight the notion that you've made it? That can make you lazy, I suppose.
Yeah. You know, it's really hard to gauge where you stand in the music business these days. And, you know, we've had a lot of great opportunities like these festivals and the TV appearance and whatnot. But, you know, for us, it's really just about keeping going, making new music and doing it as best as we can. So we try not to feel too comfortable with our situation, you know. It's best to be always striving for the next big thing. But like I said, it's just amazing to have these opportunities, and we couldn't be more thankful.
Well, NPR did their part. They mm-hmm. have this series called Tiny Desk Concerts. When musicians come to the NPR headquarters in Washington, they're asked to play a few songs in somebody's office, and your band got to do that when you were at the NPR headquarters. That must have been fun, too.
Yeah, and we're all big fans of that show and of its host, Bob Boylan. So, you know, he's kind of a pretty iconic tastemaker in music, so it's great to meet him and really an honor to play in his little office there. It's a really cool experience.
Hey, 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 hey. I've been through the desert and I've been across the sea. I've been walking through the mountains, I've wandered through the trees for the trying to fight to wanna give what I've got. She lit a fire and now she's in my heaven. Hey, 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 hey.
All right, so what's next? Touring this summer, is there a recording in your future, a second album?
Yeah, I'm writing it now, and whenever I'm home, I you know, do a little recording and get it going. You know, I don't have a deadline or anything. I'm just kind of, you know, when it's finished, it'll be finished, and hopefully between all the busy touring, we'll find time to get it done within the next year. But for the rest of this year, mostly we're just focusing on touring. We're pretty much out for the next 3 months or so, so should be quite a ride.
In terms of recording, that's kind of the beauty of indie labels. They don't have a deadline for you. You get to make the record you want to make and put it out when you think it's ready.
Yeah, that was a huge part of our decision-making process in terms of who to work with. You know, we wanted people who we trusted and liked on a personal level and who would, to some extent, stay out of our creative business, you know, just kind of let us do our thing and trust us, which they do, thankfully. So I think especially with the success so far of the first record, they're really putting their trust in us, and we're very happy for that.
Ben Schneider and his band Lord Huron will be at The Loft in Lansing on Tuesday night. Thank you for joining us on Current State.
Thanks for having me.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
And fans of live music, you can attend the filming of next year's Backstage Pass on WKAR-TV tonight at 6:30 at the Hanna Center. Free tickets online at WKAR.org. Tomorrow on Current State, we update the debate over car insurance reform in Michigan. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.